This episode is brought to you by BattleBards, premier tabletop audio for your campaigns. Use the coupon codes GMJ1, 2, or 3 to get free bonus tracks with your first order at BattleBards.com. Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, gamer! Greetings, fellow GM and or player. Welcome to episode 108 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker, and I'm transmitting to you today from the Obsidian Monolith somewhere outside time and space. So I'm going to do another world-building episode this week. This is world-building episode number 12, Portals of Primordia. I've gotten a lot of great feedback on my last couple world building episodes, so thank you very much for all the feedback. So this week I'm going to go over some of that feedback and I'm going to discuss the portals of Primordia. World building is a never-ending process that we take one step at a time, and like so many things in life, it's so much more enjoyable of an experience with friends. So join me on my journey, and let's create a world. Roll for initiative. I have gotten so much fantastic feedback from you in the past few weeks, and I really appreciate it, really appreciate all the feedback. It's just been rolling in, and it's fantastic because it lets me know that people are listening, lets me know what people are thinking about what I'm presenting, and it gives me ideas of where to go in the future with future episodes of the show. So I actually have so much feedback that there's no way that I could do it all in an episode. So what I've decided to do is I've been going through the feedback and organizing it based on subject matter. So later in the show today, I'm going to be talking about some world building feedback that I got. And I have a lot more world building feedback that I'll be discussing in future episodes. In the feedback part of the show today, I'm just going to do a little bit of just general feedback. So I heard from James Peters, who wrote in and said, "Hey-o, listening to Game Master's Journey episode 17, and you asked to hear from international listeners. Thought you might appreciate hearing that I've been listening to Game Master's Journey on my bike ride to and from my Edge of the Empire game here in Tokyo. Been listening avidly since I discovered Game Master's Journey and really enjoyed GM Intrusions before that. Keep on doing what you're doing." So thank you so much for writing in, James. That is awesome that I have at least one listener in Tokyo. Super cool. Great stuff. Thanks for writing in. David Howard also wrote in, and David says, "I really like your Primordia stuff. I've really been impressed by the way you choose to do your deities. Having one and only one deity for each domain was smart and clever. I've considered stealing that idea for one of my own games as well." So just quickly here, an aside, I have to say that wasn't actually my idea. I got that idea from the Dungeon Master's Guide in the section in the beginning of the book when it talks about creating pantheons. That's one suggestion it makes, is just, hey, take all the domains and make a god for each domain. So that's what I did. You know, I have to say, when I originally did it, I think the main reason was just that I wanted there to be a manageable number of gods. I didn't want there to be too many. And it seemed like the minimum number of gods I wanted was one for each domain. So I decided I would start there and then maybe expand beyond that. So I'm not promising that there will forever be one and only god associated with each domain. And I'm not promising that there will forever be only one domain associated with each god. The story or the world that I'm building may demand certain deities be created, or I may, for one reason or another, create a new domain and decide this domain is going to be covered by a new deity, or maybe this domain is claimed by one of my deities that already exists, that already has a domain. So ultimately, I think in the future, I would love to have enough unique domains that each deity can have two and still not have too many domains that are shared between different deities. And those that are shared are kind of like the secondary domain, not the primary domain. But I mean, only time will tell. It just depends how many domains I create, how good they are, and whether, you know, when I create a given domain, if it seems like that this should be its own god or if it would fit under the umbrella of one of the other gods. But kind of one of my design goals with Primordia is I very much want to avoid there being too many gods, and I very much want to avoid there being gods that are too similar. And a perfect example of this is the Forgotten Realms. If you go look at the pantheons in the Forgotten Realms, you'll see that there are so many gods that are stepping on each other's toes. I mean, if you went to count all the gods that are somehow associated with battle or fighting, and you include all of the, you know, non-human pantheons in Forgotten Realms, I haven't counted them, but I'd be willing to guess and bet that you'd easily end up with more than 10 deities that are sharing the same domains, sharing the same portfolio aspects. And to me, it doesn't really make sense from a cosmological point of view. I just think it's poor design. It's not elegant. And also with my aspects, which I've talked about in previous world building episodes, I'm kind of walking both sides of that line at the same time, because on the one hand, I only have 9 deities, but from a certain point of view, you could say that there could be as many deities in Primordia as there are in the Forgotten Realms if you consider all the different aspects. But they're not truly different deities, especially from the DM side of the screen. They're not different deities at all. They're the same deity. Now, from the player side, 2 aspects of a god might seem very much like different deities, but they're really not. All right, so back to David's email. He says, "World building has been fun. I've done my best not to do too much so that nothing is really wasted effort, but I've written down plenty of ideas in case I need them or want to sort through them later." And I think that's a great way to do it. You don't want to stifle your creativity, you know. So let's say you're developing a small nation that is where your PCs are adventuring. Maybe you have some great idea for a country on the other side of the ocean. It's still a great idea. You should definitely, you know, write down whatever you have for it. But I wouldn't recommend devoting much or any time to developing that idea until it becomes relevant or necessary for the story. So I think the way that David is doing this is definitely the way to go. He says, "I wanted to do something different than standard high fantasy, and both the Dark Tower and Sword and Sorcery seem different enough." Yeah, that's pretty cool. And I think it's interesting because he's talking about doing something different from high fantasy. And I think what I'm inferring from this is he's saying from kind of what we associate as D&D, right? Like Forgotten Realms kind of stuff. And he's talking about Sword and Sorcery being different from that. And I just find that really interesting because Sword and Sorcery is the tradition that D&D came from. So it kind of gives you an idea of how much the game and the settings of the game have changed since 1974. You know, now Sword and Sorcery seems different to us. So I think that's interesting. I blame the clerics. "I'm pretty close to the point where I can begin to play at least one of them. The trick with the Dark Tower story is to make things seem similar to readers, but then turn things on their heads so that folks who have read the novels expect something and they get something else." Yeah, that's awesome. You always want to keep people surprised and keep people guessing. And something that might not be clear from this passage I'm reading is David is actually developing 2 different campaign settings at the same time, which is astounding to me. And kudos and best of luck to David for doing that and with that in the future. So David actually sent me a fairly lengthy email, and this is just part of it. I'm going to be covering other parts of it in different episodes on different topics. So thank you so much for writing in, David. Yeah, David, one of his campaign settings he's developing is inspired by the Dark Tower series by Stephen King, which I think is super awesome. I'm a big fan of the Dark Tower myself. I want to take a minute to send a huge thank you and a shout out to my Tier 6 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's give it up for Steve. Yeah. Thank you, Steve. You are the man, Steve. So I want to thank Steve, and I want to thank all of my patrons. I want to thank everyone that supports Game Master's Journey. I really appreciate it. Could not do it without you. You can also check out BattleBards at battlebards.com. They're now sponsoring Game Master's Journey, and I have some coupon codes that you can use on your first order with BattleBards to get some free bonus tracks along with all the other goodies that you're going to get from BattleBards. And BattleBards provides you with quality audio for your tabletop role-playing game experience, whether that's music or monster sounds or ambient sounds, like you're in a diner or something like that. They've got all kinds of great stuff. Other great ways to support the show are using my Amazon referral links. I've also got a free trial of Audible you can check out. All kinds of stuff. So if you head to the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney, scroll to the bottom, you can find all kinds of great ways you can help out and support the show. You can find more information about those coupon codes for BattleBards, the Audible trial, all that good stuff. So definitely check it out. All right, for our main world-building topic today, I'm going to talk about the portals of Primordia. So Jesse Lex, loved the last name Jesse Lex, wrote in and had a lot of questions about the portals. So I thought a great way to start to explain the portals to you better is to start off by answering Jesse's questions. So he says, who controls the portals? If there's a monopoly, wouldn't they charge a premium for using the portals since they're so convenient? So first of all, who controls the portals is the Guild of Adventurers. The Guild builds the portals, they maintain the portals, they protect the portals, and they control the portals. They're all about the portals. And in fact, dealing with the portals is probably the lion's share of what the Guild of Adventurers is about, at least as far as their day-to-day operations and what they're spending time and energy and resources doing. A lot of it is tied to maintaining the portals. Now, I haven't completely nailed down in a finalized form exactly how all of this works as far as the kind of economical side of the portals and the kind of political aspect of the portals as far as who controls them and all of that. But what I'm thinking right now is the Guild controls the portals. You know, as I said, they create them. And obviously, the cities need these portals for their survival. They're absolutely crucial. And the reason is each of my remaining cities in the world, and there's not many, are protected by, for lack of a better term, a mythal. But these are similar to the mythals from Forgotten Realms, but they're more than that. It's basically a magical energy field around an area. And this field is produced by a powerful magical item or artifact, which exists in the center of where the field is. It creates a sphere of influence around itself. And within that sphere, it has certain effects, and every mythal is different, and they can have different effects. But one thing that all of the mythals of Primordia have in common is within that sphere of magical energy that the mythal creates, which surrounds not only the entire city of Alandria, for instance, but also all of the farmland and everything around Alandria, the whole area is contained in this magical bubble. And within that magical bubble, teleportation magic does not function. Or I should say, teleportation magic cannot cross the boundary of the bubble. So if you're within the bubble, if you're in Alandria, you can teleport from one part of Alandria to another, no problem. But you cannot teleport from Alandria to another city or outside of the bubble or the mythal surrounding Elondrid. You can't cross that boundary. On the flip side, if you're outside of that bubble, you can't teleport in. It's impossible. The spell will just fail. Also, any kind of planar travel, like plane shift or astral travel or anything like that, also cannot cross the boundaries of the bubble. So again, if you're in Elondria, you can astral travel around Elondria all you want, but you can't pass through the perimeter of the mythal, and you can't plane travel into Elondria from another plane or whatever. And that's the biggest function of the mythal as far as protecting the cities, is because one of the core ideas of Elondria is it's kind of a planar nexus. And one of my first ideas I had for the setting that kind of guided the development of the setting was, you know how when sometimes you planar travel or you teleport or you're using some kind of magic to go from one place to another, sometimes mishaps happen, and sometimes you can end up in a random place, or sometimes some kind of magic item or something, or some kind of catastrophe or something going wrong can send you to a random plane or something like that. So the idea is anytime you encounter a game mechanic that says this will send the character to a random plane of existence, for some reason, the odds of you appearing in Primordia are higher than anywhere else. Primordia, it's kind of like a gravity well. It kind of pulls things into it. So anyone who's traveling magically through the cosmos or the planes or whatever, and they don't have a fixed destination or they're going somewhere random, they tend to get sucked into Primordia. The other aspect as part of this is there are planar rifts opening in Primordia all the time. And I used to play the MMO Rift, and I'm totally stealing from that. So if you played the MMO Rift, then you know exactly where I'm going with this, and you understand how it works. But the idea is it's that anytime, pretty much anywhere, a planar rift can open, and that rift could lead anywhere. It could lead to the plane of fire. It could lead to the plane of earth. It could lead to the abyss. It could lead to some plane you've never heard of. And these rifts open into Primordia and things come out of them. Sometimes the rifts are unstable and they only stay open for a period of time and then they close. Sometimes the rifts are stable and they remain open for a long time or until someone or something figures out how to close them, which is another thing that the Guild of Adventurers does, is close rifts that are close to these cities. So one of the big jobs of the mythals is to protect a settlement from that kind of thing happening, because, you know, nothing's going to ruin your city's day than to have a rift to the abyss open in the middle of the city, right? That would be bad news. So these mythals prevent any kind of planar shifting or teleporting or anything like that from happening. And that's what makes them safe. And that's what makes them the only places in Primordia, or at least that are known, that are safe from these constant planar incursions that are happening. So let's get back to Jesse's email. He says, do the portals require some type of energy to keep them working? Even magic requires some level of energy. But if it's not energy, then wouldn't it require special proprietary magic skills required to activate portals and keep them maintained? So yes, the portals do require energy. However, the energy, I mean, it's not something you need to worry about. The portals are permanent magical items. They're probably almost on the level of an artifact. At the very least, they'd be legendary items. And your Holy Avenger sword never runs out of batteries, right? It works forever. And the same thing with the portals. They don't need to be recharged. They don't run out of energy. You don't have to change their batteries. You don't have to sacrifice people to keep them functioning or anything like that. All of that kind of cost that you're thinking of, the cost of operation, that's all front-loaded in the creation of the portal. Once you create the portal, it's forever and it will work forever. But yes, creating these portals is not easy to do, and it's not something that just anybody can do. Jesse says, do the portals create a tunnel through the ethereal plane or something that can be infiltrated by ethereal creatures or something more powerful? Do the maintainers have to keep the portals constantly defended and keep them up to keep powerful entities from breaking through? The answer all is no. And this is, you know, these kinds of questions is what made me realize that I really need to explain how they work, because a lot of people are assuming that they're teleportation circles or something like that. My portals are not anything that exists in the game. These are something I've created myself. They don't work quite like anything else in the game. And again, the reason is there are these mythos that prevent teleportation, right? So a teleportation circle isn't going to work. You might have a teleportation circle and one's in Alandria and one's in the other city and you know the sigils or whatever to go from one to the other, but it's not going to work because teleportation cannot carry you across the boundary of one of these mythos. It's impossible. So you can use teleportation circles within a given city to get from one part of the city to the other, but you can't use them to get from one city to another. Also, my portals do not function by tunneling through the ethereal plane or the astral plane or anything like that. So there's no possibility of ethereal or astral things like getting into that tunnel somehow. They don't work like that. So let me go over to my OneNote here. I have a document I wrote about portals, and let me tell you a bit about how the portals work, how they're created, and that kind of stuff. So the portals of the cities of Primordia are not teleportation circles. They are a completely different form of magical technology, if you can call it that. The portals were designed by the guild using knowledge they'd gathered from more than one ancient civilization. Each portal has two ends to it, okay, or two portals. Each end must be built separately. Building the portals is a time-consuming, laborious, and expensive process requiring exotic, rare, and expensive materials. An important element of portal construction is the keystone. The keystone is the capstone of the arch, which is really a circle, of the portal. These are carefully constructed magic items that are the focal point of the magic of sameness that creates the connection between two portals that are linked. All right, so let me try to explain this, how this works. So each portal only goes to one other portal. It's not like a Stargate where this portal can take you anywhere, okay? The portals work on the principle of sympathetic magic, okay, which is the idea of magic working based on two things being similar in some way and using that connection or that relationship of sameness to make something happen. So the way the portals work is, let's say I'm building a portal to take me from Alandria to another city. Let's call it Seattle, because there's no reason these portals couldn't take you to another world or dimension or anything like that. I mean, that's kind of the cool thing about the way they work, is they can take you anywhere if you build them right. So let's say I'm building a portal to take me from Alandria to Seattle. The way that would work is I start in Alandria and I build the actual portal, which usually looks like an arch, but it's actually a circle. There's a part of the portal that goes under the ground that you usually can't see, although some of them, the entire circle is sitting on the ground. It just depends on the aesthetics of what they want the portal to look like. But they're all a ring of a combination of exotic metals and crystals that have all been magically enchanted and whatnot. So you build this portal in Alandria, and the final part of building this portal is putting in the keystone, which is the capstone. So it's the top stone of the circle or the arch, depending how you want to look at it. And this is in itself its own magical device. So the portal, the whole portal is a magical device, but the keystone is an independent magical device that becomes part of the portal. And there is a very involved magical process, and this requires circle magic, which is a bunch of wizards working together, combining their power together, and that power being directed by one wizard that actually casts a spell, because this magic is way too powerful for one person to handle. And through this ritual, this keystone is duplicated. This isn't really the right term, but you could think of it as being cloned. Not only have we made a copy of the keystone, but it's not a copy of the keystone. It is the keystone. You're looking at two keystones, but there's really only one keystone. It's kind of a paradox, but it's kind of, I refer to it as a magical quantum entanglement. So if you're familiar with the concepts of quantum entanglement and quantum teleportation, this is a very similar idea, only using magic instead of physics. And the idea is you create these two keystones that are entangled magically, quantumly. There's actually only one keystone. There's just two instances of it. Or it's in two different places in the time-space continuum at the same time. Okay, so you've built this portal in Alandria. You've built this magical keystone. You've magically cloned or duplicated the keystone. You set the keystone in the portal in Alandria. It becomes one with the portal. And the portal, you know, that's the first step in activating that portal. Now what you need to do is you need to take the other keystone, the duplicate, to Seattle. So you have to travel there some other means first, you know, which, you know, if we're talking about two cities in Primordia, you'd have to brave the wilds to get from Alandria to wherever this other city is. But we're going to Seattle. Let's say you leave the Mythal of Alandria, so your plane shifting magic can work, and you plane shift to Earth. You go to Seattle. You go to the city center, and you decide you're going to put this portal right next to the Space Needle, or maybe on top of the Space Needle. I don't know. So now you build another portal, just like the one you built in Alandria. And for this portal, you're going to use this keystone that you brought from Alandria. Once you build that second portal, you install the keystone that you brought from Alandria, you activate the second portal, the portals are now active. And in a very real sense, even though you have a portal in Alandria, you have a matching portal in Seattle, there's really only one portal. There's not two portals, there's one portal, and that portal exists in both places at the same time. So you can see that you can enter this portal in Alandria, come out in Seattle, and vice versa, but you cannot use this portal to go anywhere else. It's like taking a subway train from one station to the other. You know, there's only one track. There's only one tube that it goes through. You know, there's no divergences. You can't go anywhere else. You just go from A to B. But that analogy is flawed because, again, there's no tunnel. There's no tube. And instead of tunneling through the astral plane or the ethereal plane or something like that, this is working more like bending space-time. So this portal, the physical portal, the physical arch, exists in both Alandria and Seattle at the same time. One side of it, you could say, is in Alandria, and the other side of it is in Seattle. And so in that place, the distance between Alandria and Seattle is literally the width of the threshold of that portal. And traveling from one to the other is as simple as stepping across that threshold. That's how they're built. That's how they work. And again, you know, this is because we have these mythals around the cities that prevent any kind of plane traveling or teleportation from functioning. So you have to have some way, if you're going to magically travel from city to city, that gets around that, right? And you also want something that's secure. You know, the stuff that Jesse's talking about, you don't want, right? You don't want things in the ethereal or the astral plane able to get into your city. You don't want someone from some other teleportation circle or whatever to be able to dial into your portal in your city and come into your city, right? You don't want that. So these portals can be activated, deactivated, and locked. And usually these functions are accessed using various runes. They're inscribed on the portal itself. All ranking members of the Adventurers Guild know how to access these basic functions. They know how to activate and deactivate the portals and lock them. Highly ranked guild members know that the portals also have a self-destruct function to be used in emergencies. And this is pretty obvious. I don't feel like I'm giving away too much of a spoiler here, because I think anybody that really thought about it very much would come to the conclusion that there has to be some kind of self-destruct sequence or something. Because what if someone, you know, what if the orc hordes invade Seattle and they capture Seattle? Well, all they got to do is walk through the portal and they're inside Alandria. They've gotten past all the defenses, and it's like the Trojan horse, you know, wait till everyone's asleep and start killing. So obviously, you know, that would be a huge security risk. And so the way that they compensate for that is the portals can be destroyed very quickly in an emergency. So if Seattle's under siege and the walls are being breached and the enemy's coming in, then someone is going to activate that self-destruct. So by the time they get to the portal, it's useless and they can't use it to get to another city. In the city of Alandria, for instance, the portals are kept open from sunrise until sunset every day. Use of the portals is free of charge for all citizens. The portals are located in Portal Square and are heavily guarded by guild members, huge statue constructs, and other secret entities, which could be things like dragons, celestials, and whatnot. And basically, my idea is, in Primordia, if you want to have an epic fight, the best place to find some of the most powerful entities in the world is around these portals, because the guild pulls out all stops and uses all of its resources to make sure that every single one of these portals are as heavily defended as they possibly could be. And anyone who thinks they're going to attack a portal or attack the guild house, which is usually nearby the portals, is in for very, very rude awakenings when they realize what they're really up against. So Jesse also asks, are the portals run by private entities or the government? What kinds of taxes would the government be charging to keep things going? And this is something else I'm still ironing out all the details of this. But my thinking right now is, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, the fact I have this Guild of Adventurers, which is easily the most powerful group in the world. And just by definition of that, they're a political group, right? Whether they want to be or not, they are. And well, I assure you, the guild is more than aware of the political power that they have, and they use it to their ends. I assure you. So I've given a lot of thought to how this would work, you know, because, you know, again, let's focus on Alandria for our example. We have this nation. It's a time of war. Cities are being lost. The powers that be in the nation decide to make their final stand in the capital city of Alandria. Everyone who can goes to Alandria to find safety. Pretty much everything else is lost except for that city. The city is protected by this ancient mythal that, in addition to preventing any kind of teleporting or anything like that, or prevent rifts from opening in the city, also, you know, prevents things like demons and undead and things like that from coming into the city. So, you know, is protecting from a lot of the things out there that are destroying cities and whatnot. So everybody withdraws to the city, and you have within the city, you know, this guild of adventurers who's like, hey, you know, we're in trouble here. You know, humanity is withdrawing to these few cities. They're very far removed from one another. We don't have the ability to keep the roads between them safe. We need another option. And the Guild of Adventurers says, hey, we can build these portals to connect the cities, and they'll be safe because each portal only has one destination, and these portals only exist within heavily fortified and defended cities protected by mythals. So there can't be any funny business. And, you know, in a last resort, if a city is overrun, the portals can be destroyed very quickly to prevent the enemies from gaining entrance to the other cities that are connected to the invaded city. So the guild creates these portals. Well, this gives them a lot of power, right? Like, right away, they're kind of in control of all the trade and all the travel and all this stuff. And you have to imagine that the queen or whatever of Alandria would be a little concerned about the guild having so much power. I mean, they could undermine her rule. They could take over, because not only do they control the portals, but their ranks are filled with adventurers, with, you know, the most powerful people in the land. So, you know, they may not have as many bodies as the Queen's army, but each of the bodies in the guild's forces are much, much more powerful than a soldier in the army, right? In the Queen's army. So obviously there would be some concern here, and obviously very quickly all these powers would come together and come to some kind of arrangement, right? And so part of this arrangement I'm thinking right now is that the guild has agreed to make access to the portals free for all citizens. So, you know, quite a few people have written in, you know, asking, because I was talking about economics in a previous episode and asking about, you know, who controls the portals and, you know, what kind of fees are there to use them and whatnot. And, you know, I'm really thinking that, you know, part of the agreement that the guild made with the city of Alondria or with the queen was that they're not going to charge for people using the portals. They're not going to profit from people using the portals, and they're not going to restrict usage of the portals to certain people. So anyone can use the portals. They're open, you know, sunrise to sunset every day, all day long. There's no fee. There's probably the equivalent of customs. You know, when people are coming through from the other side, they want to know who you are, what your business is, and things like that. I'm sure that there is magic used to make sure that people are telling the truth, make sure that people aren't magically disguising their appearance or something like that. You know, this person isn't a polymorph dragon or something like that. So there's all that kind of stuff, you know, and you have to be someone that they would allow in the city, obviously, to use the portal. But other than that, a beggar can walk through a portal, right? You don't have to be a noble. You don't have to pay or anything like that. So that was part of the deal that was made. And I'm imagining that there's this very delicate balance of powers. You know, if you think about Alondra, we've got the queen, and under her, we've got the nobles. We've got the merchants, which are a separate power base, or maybe not. Maybe the nobles and merchants are kind of merging. And that's what I imagine is kind of happening, is in this 300 years or whatever, since everyone's withdrawn to Alondria, we've gone from the situation of having nobles and merchants as kind of two separate classes that kind of, you know, sometimes or some places the nobles are more powerful, some places the merchants are more powerful or whatever, that now they've kind of begun merging to where it's more the nobles and the merchants are thrown together in one pot and they're ranked regarding how much money and influence they have. And it doesn't really matter if you're a noble or a merchant. It just matters how much influence you have as far as what your ranking is. But that'd be really complicated, right? And 300 years, I don't think, is a long time to work that kind of complexity out. So there's probably, it's probably a mess, I imagine. So you've got the queen, you've got the nobles, you've got the merchants, and then you've got the Guild of Adventurers, which is kind of this wild card, right? Because they exist beyond the city of Alondria. They have chapters or whatever you would call them in other cities. They also exist beyond humanity. Like they exist in elven cities and dwarven cities. So they're kind of in a way above and beyond Alondria, right? But yet they're operating within Alondria. They're subject to its laws. So I imagine that there's a pretty complex kind of balance of powers and shifting going on. And I imagine that there is a plethora of deals and arrangements between the guild and the queen, between the guild and the various nobles, between the guild and the merchants, so that these people can all be comfortable with the guild being in their midst and being so powerful and controlling the portals and being the only ones that know how they work and how to repair them or how to build new ones. And I haven't figured out all the details of that, but I think that if I wanted to run a political campaign in Alondria, that is definitely, that would be a big part of it. And that would be something I would really explore, is this balance of powers and how that shifts from day to day. And what are those deals that were made? You know, what are the provisions that the guild is providing to the queen and vice versa, so that they can both be comfortable with this arrangement? G. Ferguson also wrote in regarding the portals and says, also the means of the city's travel, the portals, perhaps it's not simply one portal goes to all the others. So depending who has what and where, it may not be a direct route and thus may add a bit of difficulty going to some places, as well as some folks intentionally limiting certain resources. So that's an interesting idea. And, you know, it is true that one portal doesn't go to all the others. So you could have the situation where to get from Alondria to City C, there's not a direct route. I first have to travel from Alondria to City B and then to City C. And I'm definitely ultimately, you know, once I have more of the world fleshed out, I will have situations like that because not every city trades with every other city. Building these portals is a very expensive and time-consuming process, and it takes a lot of magical energy. So, you know, they're not going to build them willy-nilly. So, for instance, in Alondria, there's, I think, 5 or 6 portals that are in the portal square. So Alondria trades with 5 or 6 other cities, and that's it. They don't have portals to the other cities. So, you know, you might be wanting to get to some city that Alondria doesn't trade with directly. So you have to figure out how to use these portals to get from one city to another and find a route through portals to get to the city that you want to get to. And that, you know, once I have nations and cities and all that kind of stuff, that would be a fun thing to map out, you know, which cities have portals to which cities, and even come up with some kind of a MacGuffin or something where the PCs have to get to some city that's going to require them jumping portals through quite a few cities to get there and having to deal with the politics and the laws and the customs of each city. I think that could be a lot of fun. And yeah, also G, I don't know what G stands for. G brings up the idea of, well, you know, maybe certain cities have resources that the others don't. And, you know, if those cities aren't as well connected, you could have, you know, kind of a trade route going through these portals from city A to B to C to D and whatnot. And those would be fun things to explore as well. G goes on to say, also, not having every portal give a direct route to all the others could give reasons for using modes of travel other than portals. In other words, getting out and adventuring. So yeah, and this was kind of, you know, I was just kind of already expounding on this a little bit. And yeah, that's definitely a way to inspire player characters specifically to go out and adventure, because they may need to go to a city that isn't connected by portals maybe, or isn't connected to a city they can get to by portals. So yeah. And I have some other ideas for getting PCs out of the city and adventuring, because that was one of the problems. And I don't think I mentioned this on the show, but in a previous episode, I talked a bit about, you know, my setup of having these isolated cities connected by portals and how it kind of opened this can of worms of problems to deal with. And one of those problems is, why would people go outside of the city, and how can I motivate player characters to go outside of the city? And, you know, one of the ways I address that was by having the Guild of Adventurers hunt monsters. And, you know, that's something I've used in my campaign so far, is they effectively have bounties out when people detect monsters outside the city. You know, someone will offer a reward for someone to take care of that monster. And so that's an impetus to get you outside of the city. But I also need motivations to go beyond that, right? That can get you right outside of the city, but it's not going to get you very far. And I want people to actually explore the world. And there's always greed, and there's all these ruins out there. And some of them are only a few hundred years old since the retreat. So, you know, that's a motivation, go plunder these ruins. But we want to have more than that. So a possible motivation could be getting to some place that isn't connected to a portal, or building a portal. Because again, you know, and I kind of set it up this way on purpose, you know, if Alondria finds out about a new city across the sea or something that they want to trade with, and they want to build a portal there, well, someone has to take the keystone to that other city, and they've got to take a ship or fly, or, you know, they have to travel physically there because they can't teleport, they can't planar travel or anything like that. So that's a possibility to spur an adventure as well. And that's one that I've actually used myself already. Now, one of my other motives that I have to give PCs to venture out of the cities is, and I talked about this in a previous episode, that I'm thinking that it's about time to for Alondria to start trying to expand. And, you know, they have two options because they're getting overpopulated. They need more farmland. They need more farms to provide food for everybody. And they just need more space. And so one of the options is extending the farmlands beyond the outer wall. And the problem with that is then they're undefended, right? So the idea is, well, we can extend, you know, maybe another mile or so beyond the wall and then build a new wall around the new perimeter, right? Well, that's going to be a huge undertaking and take a lot of time, take a lot of money, take a lot of magic, take a lot of manpower. So they're trying to find a better solution than that. And one of the ideas on the table is, well, you know, there's countless towns and villages and keeps and castles and whatnot out there that were once part of the nation that Alondria was part of that are now abandoned, or, well, they're probably not abandoned. Probably something lives there, but not humans anymore. And, well, maybe we can start to take back the ones closest to Alondria. And if we take one of these keeps back and we have powerful adventurers from the guild protecting it, and maybe we can even build kind of a minor little mythal around it or extend Alondria's mythal out to cover it, extend the shields. Maybe that could work, and we can start slowly expanding that way. And I'm actually designing a series of adventures that are using that hook and are going to bring back something to D&D that I really miss from the first edition days, and I think to a lesser extent second edition, which is the idea of having a keep or having a stronghold for your player characters. And that's part of D&D that's been lost and that I really miss. And, you know, it used to be back in the day, you got to ninth level or whatever, and you got a stronghold and you got followers and all this stuff. And so I'm bringing that back into the game with Primordia, and that's going to be part of this adventure, which I hope to one day publish, will be, you know, taking back these keeps and gaining a stronghold for your party that they can then use to attract followers and basically kind of build up their own little army if they want to. So I think that'll be a lot of fun. So I want to thank G and Jesse for emailing in and kind of spurring this discussion with their questions. And I hope I've done a bit of a better job of explaining the idea behind the portals and how they work. So, you know, again, this is something new to the game. It's not a gate. It's not a teleportation circle. It's not anything like that. This is something new that works in a very specific way, works through kind of space-time folding as opposed to traveling through other planes or anything like that. And again, the whole reason is that so that it can, one, function in these mythals that block all that other stuff, and two, be something that cannot be compromised. The only way you can compromise one of these portals is to get access to one of the portals, which means getting into one of these cities and getting access. And even then, the portals are protected by the guild. They're protected by numerous guardians, and they have self-destruct safeguards in place. So if the wrong person tries to use them, or someone unauthorized tries to use them, or someone activates the right rune or says the right command word, the thing self-destructs and is useless. So there are my thoughts. I have a lot more to talk to you about, a lot more feedback regarding Primordia to go through. Again, I want to remind you, I have a Primordia subreddit on Reddit. So reddit.com/r/Primordia, or you can find the link in the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. And, you know, if you want to start a discussion about Primordia with me and with the other listeners, that's a great place to do it where everyone can see it. Everybody can weigh in. So yeah, please feel free to use the Reddit. And I think up to this point, I'm the only one who's posted actual topics in it, but feel free to start your own topics. You know, I'm afraid that people may go there and see that I've started all the topics and feel like, oh, you know, this is kind of Lexus playground. I shouldn't start a topic in here. As long as it's relevant to Primordia, you are more than welcome to start a topic. I'd love to see more people use the Reddit. I get a lot of people commenting on Google Plus and emailing me, and that's great, but it's not a great way to really bring people together collectively. And I think the more people we have throwing ideas at things, the better ideas we can come up with. I know I say it all the time, but it's the honest truth. The thing that makes this podcast awesome is you and your feedback. I love hearing from my listeners. You guys have the greatest ideas, the greatest thoughts, the greatest feedbacks, very insightful, very helpful, and I love to hear from you. So please don't be shy. Don't be a stranger. First of all, the first place you want to check out is my website at starwalkerstudios.com. The specific page for Game Master's Journey is starwalkerstudios.com/Game Master's Journey. You can find all the episodes there, all the show notes, all kinds of good stuff. Also, if you want to email me, you can email me at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. You can follow me on Google Plus Lex Starwalker. I'm also on YouTube, Facebook, Pinterest, Reddit. I'm all over the place on the internet. You can find links to all that stuff at the website, starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney. One of the great ways you can help me out with Game Master's Journey is by leaving reviews on Stitcher and iTunes. It really helps new listeners find the show and know that this is a quality podcast worth listening to. And I like to thank people who leave me reviews because I really appreciate it and it really helps a lot. So I want to send a huge thank you for First Son of Black Acre for your 5-star review on iTunes. First Son of Black Acre says, "I was a huge fan of GM Intrusions and frankly hated to see it become something else. But in a world of adapt or die, this was the best outcome. Game Master's Journey is awesome. Lex continues his hosting duties with the same personal take that made GM Intrusions so great. Plus, now it's wide open to pretty much any game that strikes his fancy. Much like GM Intrusions, I started late, so I'm playing catch up, but I look forward to teeing up each episode." So thank you so much for that review, First Son of Black Acre. I am always, always so happy when I hear a listener of GM Intrusions who's come with me to Game Master's Journey. So great that you guys are all along with me on the journey. And I gotta say, you know, my days of talking about Numenera are not over. There will be more episodes about Numenera as part of Game Master's Journey. I might just call those GM Intrusions just for old time's sake. But I'm getting the itch to play some Numenera again. I just wish I had more time. If I had my way, I would be running a Numenera campaign and a D&D campaign every week. And I would be playing in a Numenera campaign and a D&D campaign every week. But I don't think that's going to happen. I wish it would, though. That'd be so great. I wish I had the time for that. I also want to thank Chris Foes for your 5-star review on iTunes. And Chris is coming at us from Canada. So it's so funny for me personally to say, you know, here's another international listener, which Chris totally is, no doubts about that. But Canada's like an hour away for me. So, Canada's closer than most places in the U.S. for me. But God, love Canada. Thank you so much, Chris. And Chris says, "Great informative podcast. Will make you a better player and GM." So thank you very much, Chris. And finally, I have a review from Nola Whitakers on iTunes. And thank you for your 5-star review, Nola. And Nola says, "Superb content and audio. Even when recording unplugged and without his studio, the clearness and clarity of Lex's podcast is far better than any other studio-produced RPG podcast." Wow. Thank you, Nola. That's high praise. Thank you very much. I listen to some pretty good RPG podcasts. So saying I'm the best, that's high praise indeed. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. And it makes me feel good. I try very hard to make this show sound good. I could easily cut my production time in half, more than in half, if I didn't try so hard to make everything sound as good as I can. But I think it's worth it. you know, and I take a lot of pride in the show, and I think it's worth it to give you the best audio that I can. And it just makes me feel good when people notice, because honestly, I think most people don't notice. It seems to me that most people out there either don't notice or don't care about sound quality, but I do care. And I just have to make the best podcast I can, you know? So it makes me feel good that at least some people notice and appreciate the quality that I work so hard to achieve. So thank you very much. Really makes my day when I hear from someone who appreciates all this hard work I do. And don't get me wrong, it is a labor of love. I do this because I love it. I do it because I love RPGs. I love talking about RPGs. I love helping new GMs or even older GMs, you know, helping people out. I just started playing in a D&D game with a buddy of mine here in the Seattle area. And he listens to the podcast, and he was telling me that, you know, he listens to it and enjoys it and takes notes on it and is learning a lot as a GM from it. And it's just, you know, it's really great to hear, and it makes me feel really good. I do not consider myself an expert on being a game master. I don't consider myself an especially good game master. I mean, I've got actual play up on YouTube, so you can go see me in all my glory or lack thereof and make your own judgment of how good of a game master I am. But I feel fairly confident in saying that I can't hold a candle to someone like Chris Perkins or Matt Mercer. I'm nothing special. You know, my biggest asset, I feel like, is that I've been doing this for over 20 years, you know, and I'm sure I've learned things even despite myself in 20 years, right? And I think another asset I have is that I give a lot of thought to it, and I do try to improve, and I do, you know, watch other GMs on YouTube and pay attention to GMs I play with and try to learn tricks of the trade everywhere I can. And, you know, I used to assume that everybody did that, but I've learned that not everybody does that. But I'm more than happy to share what I've learned with you. But I definitely don't consider myself an expert. I don't consider myself the best or even among the best. But, you know, I think you can learn as much, maybe even more, from watching someone who's not very good as you can from watching someone that's good. Because honestly, you know, I watch Matt Mercer, I watch Chris Perkins, and I do glean, you know, things like, oh, you know, things that they do that I like, that I want to do. Like, for instance, for Matt Mercer, I've realized that he runs D&D much like I used to before third edition, when I got kind of sucked into miniatures and grids and 5-foot steps and all that stuff. And, you know, went through third edition, 3.5 Pathfinder, and now fifth edition. And I watch Critical Role, and I see a style of DMing that's more like what I used to do, and I realize, or more like what I do when I run Numenera. And I'm like, you know, I really prefer that to the way I do it now, with that's more nitty gritty and more mechanical. I don't know what to call it. The game of squares. I feel like the players have more fun with that other style. I know I have more fun with that other style. So I'm actually going to try doing my Curse of Strahd campaign more kind of theater of the mind and get away from the grid and the miniatures and whatnot. A lot of it is I've been wanting to try it, you know, watching Matt Mercer and watching Chris Perkins and how they run D&D online, wanting to try doing it more like I'm just at a table running D&D, only it happens to be online and not dealing with Roll20, which Roll20 is fine. And for some people it's great. But for me, it's always been kind of a pain in my ass. I spend nearly as much time setting up the game on Roll20, like importing tokens and making the maps and making sure everything scales properly and the grids are lined up and all that bullshit and doing macros. Every week when I prepare for a game, I spend nearly as much time doing all that Roll20 bullshit as I do actually preparing the game. And it's just started to bother me lately, because I'm like, this is really wasted time. I think it actually slows down play. I think watching it on the stream, it slows it down, as opposed to if I just did Theater of the Mind and didn't worry about all that shit. And, you know, from a viewer perspective, at listening to it as a podcast or watching on YouTube, I think it's a lot more entertaining when you get rid of all that stuff. Like, I think my Numenera actual plays are more entertaining than the D&D ones because it's just more, it's less mechanical stuff. You know, it's less time spent rolling initiative or time spent moving tokens around or deciding if your spell can hit this guy or not. None of which is fun to watch as a viewer. And it's not even really fun to be in a group that's doing that as a player or the GM. So, we're going to try it out. And the other part was just, you know, with my move, I've had to make some changes in the studio and whatnot. And I have some different equipment now. And, I'm in a position now where I can do a setup more like what Chris Perkins does, where I have a table and I can have things spread out, where before in my studio, I had a standing desk and I didn't have any table space. So with that, you know, I couldn't have really done a whole lot theater of the mind anyway, because I didn't really have any way to keep track of it. But now that I have an actual table in front of me, I want to try it. So we'll see. It will either improve the experience or make it worse, or it won't make a change. We'll see. So check out my actual play on YouTube. Links in the show notes. So again, thank you for the reviews. I really appreciate it. Please keep the feedback coming in, whether you're emailing me, tweeting me, hitting me up on Google+ or Reddit, or leaving reviews and any kind of feedback. I really appreciate it. What you like, what you don't like. I'm always trying to make the show better. And like I said before, I've got more to go through as far as feedback in future world building episodes. I've already received quite a bit of feedback on my discussion of the merchants and nobles and economy of Alandria. So I'm going to be covering that pretty soon. So if you have something to say about that, definitely let me know soon. And I'll also be doing a full review of Curse of Strahd in the near future. And I'll be returning to my series on the cleric in D&D. Got some great feedback for that as well. And I want to talk to you about what I'm doing with the cleric in Primordia and what I'm doing with the gods and religion in Primordia to try to make the cleric a more appealing option to players, so I see more players playing clerics. So lots of good stuff on the horizon for Game Master's Journey, so I hope you stay tuned. And I also hope that you get a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. And I will be back soon with yet another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music provided by Cloudwalker, Renfield, Stanko, Transboy, and Ish. Please see the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/GameMaster's Journey.